disaster. Don't you give up, don't you let away. Talking about a forever after. Don't you give up, don't you dare give in.
Yes, we're trying not to give up. And we're trying to avoid disaster, but it's getting increasingly precarious out there. Greetings, friends. This is Jack Tuckner and Deborah O'Rell with you, the women's rights in the workplace advocates from Tuckner, Sipser, Weinstock, and Sipser. And how are you, Deborah?
Fantastic. And you?
Outstanding, but I'll get better. Thank you. So we'll be with you for the next hour, so get ready to get aggravated, as we'll be chatting about the global war on women. And over the next few weeks, we'll have several guests joining us who are actually doing something about that war. So stay tuned to this spot on your digital dial, as next week we'll be speaking with Sherry Lywant, who's the co-president of abetterbalance.org, and she'll be our guest here on March 31st.
Yeah, next Monday.
And just a little bit about Sherry Lywant. From 2005 to 2006, she was an adjunct professor of law at the City University of New York Law School of Law, my alma mater, where she taught an upper-level class on civil rights. And from 96 until 2005, Sherry was a senior staff attorney at the National Organization for Women Legal Defense Fund. And she ran the State Advocacy Project, working on issues intersecting women's rights and poverty, including reproductive health, violence, and child care. And prior to that, she spent 12 years as a senior staff attorney at the Welfare Law Center, which is a national legal organization doing litigation and public advocacy on a variety of progressive income support issues around the country. Sherry was a U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, and she graduated summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa from Princeton University and Columbia University School of Law. Not too shabby. So we'll be looking forward to speaking with her.
I'm really looking forward to speaking to her.
And we'll be speaking to her because she has drafted, and it's terrifically timely, and we're really, you know, honored to have her here. She drafted a majority of the paid sick leave bills that have been introduced across the country, including the New York City, the brand new New York City legislation, which is effective April 1st of this year, which you could read about online, which expands paid sick leave to 500,000 formerly uncovered New York City workers who had no paid time to take off for themselves or for a child. It expands that coverage even for an ill family member who is not a child or not yourself or not your husband. I believe it includes parents, spouses, aunts, close family members that don't have to be necessarily in your nuclear family. And that's for all employers with five or more employees, which starts April 1st. So that's really an outstanding, will lessen a lot of suffering.
About all of the waiters who've sneezed on you.
That's right, or on your food that you don't know about.
Right.
Because
exactly.
They couldn't take a day off from work. I mean, we're the beneficiaries of that. Hello. So we're really paying for their coming to work ill and getting us infected and sick.
Yes.
So, and I believe the following week we'll be speaking with Daniel O'Donnell, I believe he'll be here on April 14th. Daniel O'Donnell is a Democratic member of the New York State Assemblyman, and he was instrumental, introduced, in fact, originally in 2007, the Marriage Equality Act, a bill that, of course, ultimately became law and was signed in 2011 by Governor Andrew Cuomo. But Daniel, Assemblyman O'Donnell, was instrumental in getting that law sponsored and passed. And he's also, Assemblyman O'Donnell, was the prime sponsor of the Dignity for All Students Act. This is New York's anti-bullying law, which was signed into effect on 2010. Particularly important piece of legislation for us in our office. We're always talking about bullying, more in the workplace, but certainly bullying of students, and particularly the students who get bullied, leading often to depression and, at times, I understand, suicidal attempts and sometimes successful suicide attempts. So it was an extremely important piece of legislation. And to follow Assemblyman O'Donnell, and along the same subject line, we will have I'm not sure of the date. Are you in April when Professor David Yamada will be with us?
But it's shortly after.
David Yamada, professor, the premier legal expert on workplace bullying in the United States. Don't miss that show.
Definitely. And also subscribe to Minding the Workplace. It's his blog, and it is full of really important information.
Yes, it is. He is the author of the Healthy Workplace Bill, and he's founder of the new Workplace Institute at Suffolk Law School, where he is a professor of employment discrimination. So, speaking of precarious and avoiding disaster, did you see that study sponsored by NASA, the space folks, NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center? This was just last week, predicting a societal collapse that not unlike the theme of Dr. Paul Ehrlich's population bomb book, a collapse of civilization from overpopulation and global famine. This was a study that was first brought to light by the Guardian newspaper. And, you know, the bottom line is that the study uses mathematical modeling to slot the world's people into two categories, the elites, also known as the rich, and the commoners, known as the poor, and using five risk factors in the equation. I found this absolutely fascinating. Population, climate, water, agriculture, and energy. The report determines that the elites will consume too much of everything, leading to a famine among commoners that will eventually cause the collapse of society. I know, but what we're talking about now, and this is, as I mentioned, there was the filmmaker, documentarian who produces or directs the show Vice, is it, on HBO? Was on Bill Maher this past week, and he was saying we're about 80 years behind in our predictions that, you know, there are a number of, I'm not a scientist enough to understand this, but, you know, these feedback loops that are already beyond our ability. If we stopped everything now, carbon emissions, if we cut by 80%, maybe we'd have a chance of surviving into the 21st century. But really what – and I heard another climatologist on Tom Hartman this week also corroborating this and saying that we're lucky if we make it as a species to the year 2040. I mean, I just – again, you're not going to see this on the corporate media, and maybe it's something we shouldn't all simply just now – This climatologist, this emeritus professor, was saying that we should all live like we're in hospice now. That really all we can really do, I mean, because we're not cutting emissions, we're actually enhancing global carbon emissions. So if we, you know, perhaps, listen, you know, there are extinctions like the last, if it was the Permian extinction 80,000 years ago, every 80,000 years apparently there's an enormous distinction. And apparently we're up next. The researchers in this NASA study say that, quote, the fall of the Roman Empire and the equally, if not more advanced, Han, Mauryan, and Gupta empires, as well as so many advanced Mesopotamian empires, are all testimony to the fact that advanced, sophisticated, complex, and creative civilizations can be both fragile and impermanent. Europe, by the end of this century, this study writes, will be a continent after the neutron bomb. The grand buildings will still be standing, but the people who built them will be gone. We are living through a remarkable period, the self-extinction of the races who, for good or ill, shaped the modern world. So this type of, you know, this type of news that, you know, seems to me, if it is true and we are, you know, essentially doomed, how do we all live now as if to make a difference if some of us make it through, you know, this sort of Armageddon, and we come out on the other end of this sort of Mad Max type of road warrior scenario. You know, and I was also thinking about this, you know, and what has led up to this, and how many people, do you know, Deborah, how many people died in all the wars, massacres, slaughters, and oppressions in just the 20th century? So in the 20th century alone, 100 years, here are a few atrocitologists. There's a word for you that I came upon for the first. Atrocitologists, those who study atrocities. The estimate is 203 million people. 203 million people in the 20th century alone were murdered. This is by us. This is
killing
humans.
Ourselves.
Killing ourselves, killing each other, creating the suffering because we're mad. 203 million people, and you could check this out on necrometrics.com, and this is also, I saw there were a lot of references for this type of these types of predictions coming from actual scientists. This isn't science fiction. So between the man-made climate change that's potentially ending civilization as we know it, and the worldwide violence against women that's still with us, it's kind of hard not to believe that there isn't a connection somewhere between human unconsciousness and madness and the devaluation of all things feminine and female.
Well, first of all, I think I picked a bad week to quit smoking glue or sniffing glue.
Smoking crack.
Smoking crack, one of them. But this is what came up, what we talked about briefly, I think even last week or the week before. Men, testosterone has been ruling the planet.
World's most dangerous drug.
And therefore, there's not enough estrogen in the world. And when we look at just the United States, the wars we've gone into, the way we treat our the lesser among us, the needier, the poor, the disabled, the older, the people who have less, is reflected and ruled by testosterone.
Right. That madness, that's right. But this is the same madness that has got us where we are, which apparently is an irreparable end to our the sort
well,
of
I the, can't believe that.
You don't believe? Okay.
Well, it's not that I don't believe
it. That's like the Republican
woman
who just refused to believe.
I know. Let me rephrase that. I know. Let me rephrase that. I don't mean I don't believe that, but I am too much the optimist not to feel. Because did you ever see that study right after 9/11? So there is some kind of measuring the energy on our globe constantly from the North and the South Pole. And it remains essentially a steady number going straight across. On 9/11, all of a sudden, this graph went like this, shot up, and then gradually came back down within a half an hour period of time. And what they figured out communication the way it is, that at the moment that the plane hit the first building and the images of that began to go out around the globe, and it took about 20 minutes, that at that peak, the collective global gasp, caused the energy, the electromagnetic field around the planet to change profoundly. So it came up and then it came down. And for those who remember, right after 9/11, there was an energetic feeling, particularly in New York City, but around the world, about oneness, getting together. I know you're looking saying that the point is, if we all get on the same page, we can change it. So that's the part that I don't believe this is hopeless.
Well, I appreciate that, and I was only making, a face because it seemed a little bit more mystical. I understand that the energy and what might have happened.
No, that's not mystical.
We're talking scientific facts that are not saying we can't. The science now apparently that is coalescing around this is, try as we might, it's too late, and we're not paying attention to there may be, and maybe that is 30, 40 years until doom. Hopefully, that is a gloomy gust, and we'll be able to change that. But NASA said they factored this in. The study discounts the effect of technological advancements in both food production and
I'm not talking about technological advances. I'm talking about people and heart energy and being on the same page and being of one mind.
Okay, well, I don't think that heart energy is changing the jet stream that we have permanently, completely messed up.
Yeah, well, I believe that's what the 9/11, that moment, proves. But anyway.
All right. Well, we'll agree to disagree about that a tad. I just thought we tend to focus on. I mean, the reason, if there is a connection between, and let's assume that there is human madness and what we're doing to this planet, this living body that is a planet. We're obviously, you know, destroying it, and we're mad. We're killing 200 million of each other. We live in that state of sort of, well, like Klingons. We're just completely sort of unconscious. We go about our lives like the future is more important than now, and that we're not all in this together. There's a certain, you know, crazy madness that one day, perhaps when we come out of this some version of an extinction, I think we'll learn and we'll probably evolve. And hopefully we can evolve a little bit before it's too late. I mean, I agree with you. It's just that gender inequality and violence against women and girls around the world, I mean, when you look at this too now, what's to explain this, and where will this take us? That all over the globe, violence and discrimination against women and girls, it violates their human rights, severely compromises young people's sexual and reproductive health, but still harmful practices that we don't talk about every day are still common. We're talking about female genital cutting and mutilation. Femicide. Gender-based violence in early marriage, damaging girls' physical being and self-worth by reinforcing gender-based marginalization and inequality. These inequalities and biases, you know, pervade countries worldwide. What prevents women and girls from fully realizing their, I would argue, innate right to reproductive health and their innate right to equality. So if discrimination and discrimination... You know, we don't talk about this in our workplace practice, of course, fortunately, but discrimination against women and girls often begins at conception. Not so much here, but especially in Asia and in Africa. Throughout significant parts of those two continents, there's a strong preference for having sons.
Right.
And girls can be perceived as a financial burden for the family due to the small income contributions and the costly dowry demands. So prenatal sex selection and infanticide accounted for the prenatal termination and death of 500,000 girls per year, 500,000 girls per year over the last 20 years. This was just in the Republic of Korea. And 30% of pregnancies identified as female fetuses were terminated in various countries throughout Asia. We're contrasted with over 90% of pregnancies identified as male fetuses resulted in a normal birth. So to not spend, you know, the rate of femicide, what is femicide? The murder of women and girls has significantly escalated over the last few years. In Mexico, the high murder and disappearance rate of young women in Juarez has received international attention for the last 10 years with an alarming recent resurgence. In Guatemala, the number of femicides has risen steadily from 303 in 2001 to 722 in 2007, with the majority of victims between the ages of 16 and 30. And again, it goes on and on and on. And by the way, I think I forgot to give out our phone number for those of you champing at the bit to call in. Our number is 888-874-4888. Again, our toll-free number is 888-874-4888. I mean, if a bride, somebody's daughter cannot meet the financial demand of her dowry, she's often subjected to torture, harassment, and death by the groom's family. The UNFPA estimates that 5,000 women worldwide are burnt to death in murders disguised as kitchen accidents each year because their dowry was considered insufficient. In India and Pakistan, thousands of women are victims of dowry deaths. In India alone, there were 7,000 dowry deaths in 2005, and the majority of victims were aged 15 to 34. This wouldn't be a complete recitation if I didn't talk about honor killings, so-called, taking place today, Pakistan, Turkey, Jordan, Syria, Egypt, Lebanon, Iran, Yemen, Morocco, and other Mediterranean Gulf countries, where women put to death for an act that is perceived as bringing shame to their families, which of course occurs for anything such as adultery, even if that adultery
was a rape. Right.
Bing, bing, ding, ding, ding.
You know, and as horrific as the numbers are for women who are murdered, what's even more painful to me, and then hopefully we're going to move on to something, because this is just so depressing, but the women, the young girls who live, but who do not have an opportunity for education. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. education has, you know, educate a young girl, and they are healthier, they have children later, they make more money, they mm-hmm. have a stronger life.
Right.
A stronger and better life. And these girls, because they get their period and they cannot go out, they, you know, they're shunned, they're treated horribly, they're denied the opportunity of an education.
Education is key.
Education
is key.
Completely.
But the education is also lacking, and including what's going on in this country. We're going in the opposite direction in terms of educating women and girls internationally. And certainly, we're making it harder here. I mean, we have an over $1 trillion student debt that could be wiped out in 2 seconds by the government. And it makes it impossible, very difficult increasingly, for our own youth to get a leg up and to make a difference,
right.
Because they are saddled. So, look, you're right. I'll move on from this. I just, the numbers
right, every
are...
Every time my kids are drop out of school because the planet's going to self-explode, why bother? They won't even have their student loans paid off.
Right. But, I mean, did you know...
Jack, this is, like, so depressing.
I know. It's very depressing. But it's important that we know it's depressing. How about, a dose of reality? Did you know that female genital mutilation causes serious injury to millions of young women each year? I mean, this is removal of all a part of a young woman's genitalia for non-medical reasons.
Right.
It's just... Okay, so... the totals between 100 and 140 million women and girls have undergone female genital mutilation worldwide. So we could move it from all of these depressing statistics into our own depressing statistics here.
Yeah.
Because listen, Republican politicians aren't responsible for all the world's ills, and certainly are not responsible for 100,000 or 100 million genital mutilations. But they certainly perpetuate many of the injustices and suffering that occurs right here on our turf. And I thought this week as we were reviewing what to discuss, and again, anybody wants to call in can call in about any actual workplace, women's rights in the workplace topic that we would be happy to address. But, everything is connected. There is an unquestionably a Republican war on women in this country. Which what does that mean? The war on women, which has really gone on steroids sort of since, the Tea Party has taken over the Republican Party, describes the legislative and the rhetorical attacks on women and women's rights taking place across the nation. It includes a wide range of policy efforts designed to place restrictions on women's health care, as we know, and to erode protections for women and their families. Some examples at the state and federal level have included restricting contraception, cutting off funding for Planned Parenthood, state-mandated completely medically unnecessary ultrasounds, abortion taxes, abortion waiting periods, forcing women to tell their employers why they want birth control or need it, and prohibiting insurance companies from including abortion coverage in their policies. Larry Flint of... what was his
Hustler?
Famous Hustler
Penthouse?
Magazine, right?
No, Hustler.
Hustler. He famously said last year that he is sure that there's a Republican out there who isn't, in his heart, a racist, but he's never met one. And in an interview with someone, a HuffPost reporter, the legendary publisher said that people often ask him why he's always knocking Republicans, and he said, and I quote, "I've been around for a long time," he explained. "I've never met a Republican that wasn't mean-spirited and in his heart a racist. I never met one that wasn't. Now, I'm sure there are probably some that are not, but I'm just telling you what my experience has been and my exposure to conservative Republicans. They're a nightmare." Flint, he went on to point out that Republicans were on the wrong side of, quote, every single social issue, from
right.
immigration to reproductive rights and equal pay for women. So I have to say publicly right here, I've just personally never met a modern-day Republican who wasn't in his heart a sexist. But if I'm open, I'm open to meeting one. If anyone knows a Republican who actually cares about women, please give us a call. And please give us a call about anything else that's on your mind related to the status of women at 888-874-4888, and we'll be happy to take your calls. By the way, I just would
on that war on women and the Republican, tomorrow is the Hobby Lobby Supreme Court.
Yes. Right.
Right? You want to talk
yes.
about that?
Well, they are, again, it's very important to this company that their employees not be allowed to purchase or have contraceptives under their health care plan.
Turn it around. They, because it is contrary and against their religion, they do not want to be forced to have to provide it. So that's their distinction, that right. we don't want to have to provide this because it's against right. our religion.
Right. It's a red herring, a canard. Yeah. It has nothing to do with their religion, but it does have to do with the women among us,
yeah.
their bodily health. Do you have, you know, the War on Women video produced
yes.
by MoveOn.org? Is it queued up right there?
I hope so.
Just like to give a listen to statements made by prominent Republican personalities as repeated verbatim by women in this very moving piece that can be found, the extended version on YouTube, the War on Women video produced by MoveOn.org.
Back in my days, they used Bayer aspirin for contraceptives. The gals put it between their knees.
Forcing women to have an ultrasound before an abortion is justified because they already made the decision to be vaginally penetrated when they got pregnant.
The agenda of Planned Parenthood includes sexualizing young girls through the Girl Scouts.
The vast majority of abortions are matters of lifestyle convenience.
A woman impregnated through rape should accept that horribly created gift. The gift of human life. Accept what God has given you and make the best of a bad situation.
Why should the government force you to insure for contraceptives? Are they going to have to insure for toothpaste? I mean, this is ridiculous.
If we are going to pay for your contraceptives and thus pay for you to have sex, we want you to post the videos online so we can all watch.
That's Rush.
If we took away women's right to vote, we'd never have to worry about another Democratic president. It's a personal fantasy of mine.
That's Ann Coulter.
These aren't our words.
That's right.
They're all real things said by prominent members of the Republican Party.
Judging from their comments, the GOP must have a serious problem with women.
And until the Republicans get over their issues,
we women have got a serious problem with the Republican Party.
This year, women will outvote men by 10 million.
You might want to keep that in mind.
We're women and we vote.
Nicely done. Can you imagine? Rush Limbaugh is my favorite. Hey, you know what the latest assault is on women's rights? It's hot off the press. Hey, I don't know about you, Deb, but there's nothing that sets the mood for a romantic evening for me like having to petition a judge for permission to have sex in your own home at the end of the night. And you know what? If Massachusetts State Senator Richard J. Ross, Republican, gets his way, that's exactly what many people, and of course mostly women, would have to do if they have children and they're going through a divorce. In fact, not only would permissionless coitus be banned, but so too would the romantic evening and many dating activities. Ross has proposed a criminal, they haven't yet set the liability, but criminal liability, seeks to amend the Massachusetts divorce law with the following provision added. Quote, in divorce, separation, or 209A proceedings involving children and a marital home, the party remaining in the home shall not conduct a dating or sexual relationship within the home until a divorce is final and all financial and custody issues are resolved, unless the express permission is granted by the courts. See, the reason that this is a war on women bill is that
completely
most, you know why? I mean, most of the time they're talking about in a divorce situation with kids, and probably was the good Senator Richard Ross has probably went through a divorce and had the situation where the wife stays in the marital residence, gets custody most of the time, still gets custody, the children stays in the home, and the control issue is for the year or two or three that it takes the divorce to wend its way through the courts and be finalized, she's not allowed to have a boyfriend. And that's what this is all about. So she can't have sex until they're divorced. And again, it's clearly, it's written as a gender-neutral law, but most of the time, the men are not staying in the marital residence with the female moving out and leaving the man with
how are you going to,
enforce that?
Enforce it, exactly.
Well, the daddy finds out, the kids tell her, mommy had her boyfriend over here tonight, and daddy goes and gets, goes to court and says, this is now illegal. We have her arrested. She can't do it. Just think of the opprobrium, that great for the kids, isn't it? I mean, but again, back to again controlling women, and this is last week. These are current United States pending. This is a pending legislation. It just brought me to again reviewing, and while I was on MoveOn.org, they list, and you can find this very easily, of course, on the internet at MoveOn.org. Great organization. You should sign. Devin on the line, please put her through.
Hi,
Devin.
Hi, Jack.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. You have a question for us here?
I do. I do. It's a pleasure to be able to reach out to you like this. I've been holding a position for about 9 months, right in New York City, at a premier rooftop bar, and I'm now becoming quite uncomfortable with my manager, who has been hitting on me basically every shift that I work for the past 9 months that I've been employed there. And, you know, as a bartender, there's a certain amount of advances that are unwelcome that one can expect. But this is becoming something that I'm really unhappy to go into work, and I have to hold this job. I need it to live. So I'm sort of wondering now, with all of this discomfort, if I have any options, if there's anything I can do about how he speaks to me, and just the general conditions that I'm working under with this guy.
Well, that's a great question, and let's talk it through. Now, well, let's not talk about or repeat the name of the establishment, but we'll just talk about this is a
okay.
Is it a restaurant or a bar or both? What is it?
It's actually both. It's a lounge as well, but I'm primarily serving alcohol and actually work until 4 a.m. until close, just serving alcohol.
Okay. And do you know how many employees that they employ, approximately?
Oh, well over 100.
Oh, okay. So it's a large, it's a nice-sized place.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
How long have you worked there?
Well, I've been working there for about 9.5 months now.
Okay. And so just tell us a little bit more about the nature of the sexual harassment.
Well, you know, and I'm not, you know, again, I'm really not sure where the line is drawn for what is harassment and what is not. But, you know, he's been, more recently, he calls me, not by my name, but he calls me baby or honey or sweetie, which is, you know, certainly unwelcome. But more or less, I feel like I have to entertain him every time I come in because he's soliciting, flirtatious responses from me. He comments on when I look hot and when I don't. And if ever I respond firmly or I say, you know, knock it off, or even playfully try and let him know that I'm uncomfortable with his comments and the things that he's saying, he then makes what I feel are very inappropriate and unprofessional remarks like, oh, are you on your period? And it's also become more recently, he feels comfortable enough to sort of touch me and to come up behind me when I have a question on the POS system. And so it's really just quickly becoming far too close, for comfort at all of our interactions.
Okay. Yeah, literally. Wow. Sorry to hear
yeah.
that. His relationship to you is what, again?
Well, he's my manager, and he's actually really the only one that I... He's the only employee that I answer to.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not as far up. I know that the owner, comes around, and I know of him. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that they are related, my manager and the owner, so I would be uncomfortable to approach the guy above him. But yes, he's my manager. He schedules me. I work almost every shift with him.
Do you feel that, while we certainly agree with you, that this, you know, that sexualizing nature is, you know, unlawful and uncomfortable and not something you should have to put up with, but you did mention it's sort of a lounge environment. Does he feel free to treat are there other female bartenders? And does he treat them the same way?
Yes, Jack. I mean, this is pretty much, there's essentially no male employees other than busboys. So this is, and because it's actually quite a competitive job to get, it's all girls. It's all pretty girls. And that's the job. And it's sort of understood, and I guess 90% of all of these girls that I work with just deal with it.
Right.
You know, but yeah, it's all women, and he certainly, you know, speaks to all the girls like they are objects, but it's sort of just expected and accepted.
Okay, sort of par for the course in this place. Now, is there anything that passes as far as a human resource department? Is there an office?
I really don't know, and I've just recently, you know, been sort of looking into what can I do. But I haven't looked. I'm looking sort of as outside and as far away from my job as possible so that I'm not compromising this position. Because, like I said, there are so many people employed. I mean, heads roll all the time. And I'm a 24-year-old recent college graduate. I mean, I can't lose this job.
Right.
Really can't.
Right. Well, okay, so that's the balance. You know, when you have a job like this, when you say you can't lose it, you can't lose it because it's, you know, given as a bartending job, particularly lucrative? You know, is it a job you can't easily replace?
Right, it is particularly lucrative. And for the amount of hours that I work,
right.
with the rest of my time being dedicated to my studies,
right.
I'm living off of it, and, you know, just barely.
Right. Well, what's sort of interesting and kind of maybe a little bit challenging about this particular scenario, and Deborah, and you'll tell me what your thoughts are as well, tell Devin, is that you're in an environment working till 4 in the morning, it's a bar, people are intoxicated, it's almost, they're all women, female bartenders, it's partly, how do they have you dress? What is their dress code?
Well, yeah, the dress code is dress sexy, and I quote.
Right. See, I mean, obviously already we're in the territory where it's sort of all problematic. It's just that in places where this happens, and if you're making a lot of money, you know, it's like how much do you go along with this to get along in this particular environment before you draw your line in the sand and say, I don't really care if I'm making $500 a night or whatever it is.
Right.
I'm not going to put myself in this position. I can make more money and might as well go all the way. You know.
Right.
To the extent that you're feeling that it's less about your skill set as an outstanding bartender and your personality and how many drinks you can juggle and all of that, it's just more about, you know, the flirtation and making the manager happy. You know, first of all, is he... does it stop at the sexualite calling you hot and flirtation, or does it, you know, is there a point where you're concerned that he's hitting on you and expects more, or is this what he does with all of the young women and it's just kind of his, hey, sweetie, honey, baby, and you know that that's all you have to put up with? Is there something that, you know, is there a reason why, something that drove this to the level where you say, I can't put up with this anymore, I won't put up with it anymore, because it's not just, you know, how's it going, beautiful? Is there something else that he expects from
Right. Oh, I guess I just feel it's generally feels just, I mean, it's not even, it's kind of unfriendly at this point. It's not that I'm afraid that he's actually going to physically harm me, or that I'm going to really be in a situation that is really scary and dangerous. And I think that that's where I even feel like, why even reach out? Because, again, this is money and this is what it is expected, but it's not really friendly, because when I don't play with him and I'm exhausted and coming into my shift to really tend to my customers who are paying me. Right. You know, he's rude and he'll give me attitude and then I feel it for the rest of the shift and he makes comments, he makes it difficult for me to reschedule shifts if he's feeling like I'm not being, you know, like I'm not rewarding him with some type of, you know, feel good.
Right, right. Well, first of all, what the law requires you then to do, you know, if you've done what you can do to say, and sounds like you have, saying, you know, just knock it off, come on, you know, kiss your mother with that mouth, whatever you would say to him, and it's not working, you need to formally complain. And we'll talk about what that means. You know, formal complaint is, and there's, if the owner, if right now we've only identified, you know, there's no corporate headquarters for this restaurant that you're aware of.
Well, I mean, there must be. It really is such a huge, it's a really huge establishment with so many people.
So, you know, one thing is you could look into that and see if it is a successful urban bistro, and it may very well be a corporate, you know, there may be sort of a corporate environment, there may be many others that they own. And if there is a corporate, you know, HQ somewhere and somebody in a suit, and there probably is, your obligation is to formally complain and to say to write a letter if that's probably the best way to do it, saying, you know what, I've been a bartender here for 9 months. I do an outstanding job. I love working here. You know, I've just graduated from college, whatever, and I would like to continue going on, you know, adding value with this restaurant. Unfortunately, I feel that I'm being treated differently at work. I'm being discriminated against. I'm being sexually harassed. I mean, that's, you know, one has to just say that, unfortunately, the treatment that I'm getting as a woman, which wouldn't be happening to me were I a man, is making me uncomfortable. It's illegal. It would be no different than if you were a woman of color, let's say, and you were saying, I'm uncomfortable because he makes me feel this way because of certain kind of racial comments he makes that are, you know, that are, I think, are racist, and it makes me uncomfortable because of who I am. And if you fill in the blank with anything, race, color, ethnicity, age, religion, etc., it's the same laws. And in a classic environment where, you know, it's happened to women as we're speaking now in the workplace, the question is, are you ready for that sort of Rosa Parks moment? You know, as I always say, the sort of line in the sand where you say, you know what, I'm actually not going to the back of the bus today, if you will. I'm just not. I'm not going to. Maybe you have a conversation, or if this is, I believe you said it was in New York City, in New York and in New Jersey, for two states that we regularly deal with clients from. These two states are so-called one-party consent jurisdiction states for tape recording. So, for instance, you could have if you have your smartphone, your iPhone, and you're with this manager, and whether you sit down with him and you say to him, if you sat down with him and you said, you know, Joe, I just, you know what, maybe not for nothing, I think you're, you know, a real nice guy, but is there any way you could, I'm uncomfortable when you sexualize me. I'm uncomfortable when you speak to me that way. I'm uncomfortable when you remark on my body. I'm uncomfortable when you touch my body, frankly. It just makes me really uncomfortable. And he says whatever he says. Now, you could be tape recording that meeting without his knowledge. That is legal in New York. It is legal in New Jersey. It is not legal without that person's permission in Connecticut. And one can Google one's own state and look it up. But it is legal in many states. So talking to you in, about a New York situation, the reason that I'm mentioning this, it's an incremental way, without having to even go to corporate. You could just go right to the horse's mouth, so to speak, and just to talk to him and say, as you say you've done, but in a little bit more of a, can we just sit down and talk about something that's bothering me? And the idea is you're formally pushing back and complaining, and you're objecting. You are, this is part of the law, opposing an unlawful employment practice, and even more important, because I wouldn't waste it on a conversation with him if you weren't recording it, because it'll be then a she said, he said, he'll deny it. If he says anything to you that sort of acknowledges that he's been, if he doesn't say, I don't know what you're talking about, young lady. If he says, I don't know what you're talking about, get out of my, you know, office, that's one thing. If he says, well, come on, that's too bad. If you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen, sister. This is the way it works around here. Or I'm sorry that, you know, that you feel that way, but this is me, whatever. If he says anything that sort of shows that you're not just making this up, you've got a record of this now. And then it depends, you know, then if it didn't stop and you said, you know what, I didn't go through, you know, I may lose this job, but it may be worth it to me to take a position for my own sort of standing up for my own civil rights, speaking truth to power. Maybe he won't do this. Maybe we'll teach them a lesson, because this schmobo is really not, they're not going to actually probably permit him to go on doing this with everyone, because the owners will know it's not worth the risk, the exposure, the liability, the attorney's fees, and having to deal with him just because he wants to get off on, you know, trolling the workplace for love interests or whatever. He doesn't get to do that. So if you had this conversation with him and just try it, where you're not threatening him, you know, you come off and you're, you know, you have this conversation in your best girly girl way, in a sort of very soft way, you could be, you know, coming to him to say, I please need your help to just kind of back off and see me as a person. Maybe it'll work. But if it doesn't work, you've got potentially proof that you've made a complaint to him, that you've said no to this person who has then said to you, too bad, you take it or leave it, or, you know, grow a pair. And then,
if you do get fired, or he cuts your hours, or gives you a crappy schedule,
right, you have proof of the so-called retaliation. And the other part of this is, at that point, let's just say he doesn't take you seriously. He says, you know what? Let me tell you something now, young lady. You better grow eyes in the back of your head, because I'll be coming up. I'm going to look to mess with you. You're giving me, who do you think you are, blah, 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 and something, anything like that. You then could go and should then formally complain to the powers that be. If it's not, you know, this isn't a company where you have a human resource director, then you write a letter and you send it in some provable way to this owner saying, you know what, I feel I'm being, unfortunately, sexually harassed. I love my job. I'm your best bartender, et cetera, but I don't think I need to put up with X, Y, and Z and A, B, you know, all of this stuff. It makes me very upset. I'd like to meet with you at your earliest convenience to discuss these serious workplace issues. You know, please help me, you know, Devin. And then the idea that they will have to, and when you write a letter like this to, you know, the company, typically they understand that it's game on, that it's like DEFCON 3, that it's like checkmate time. They get it. They hear it.
Right.
And they'll have
right.
to talk with you about it. And you know what? They have to investigate it. And if they determine from speaking to you and speaking to Knucklehead and speaking to the other women in the workplace that, you know what, he is inappropriate. He is allowing himself, he's walking around here like this big swinging you-know-what, and allowing himself to be the big pasha and treat all of these young women like they're, you know, objectifying everyone. He objectifies you. Then they're on the hook. And you know what? They may fire him. They may tell him that he can't treat you and others this way. And they may do it because it's there. Once you escalate that to management, to the people who are responsible, it's their, you know, butts that are on the line if anything happens to you, like they allow him to fire you, or if they fire you, then you have a case of sexual harassment, a case of illegal termination and retaliation. But you see, we don't want that to happen to you,
right?
Because if you can salvage this job again, and so there are people who, you know, I was telling a story on the air, Devin, last week about my mom, who worked many years ago in an environment at the Jack Lane Health Club in the 70s, where she was sexually harassed regularly, and they dressed her up also in this little tutu, and it was expected to play. She was expected to sort of flirt with men. There were no laws, and she sort of had to deal with it and dealt
right.
with it well. And some would say, and some of your colleagues may say this now, hey, as long as I'm not being molested or sexually abused, whatever my line is, hey, I'm pulling down, you know, $2,000 a week, I'll deal with it. I mean, that you have to consider in a somewhat sounds like this, you know, if this is something of a mercenary job that you're not planning on staying for life, how long that you can and that you wish to put up with it. But we would certainly be encouraging you to say, you know what, it's not about giving up the ghost or throwing out the baby with the bathwater on this thing. You should. Why should you give up the job? Why should you have to know that you're getting out of the shower and getting ready for work, and that you're going to have to deal with this debasement every night? You know, and again, to the extent some people say, we've had clients who say to us, you know what, to a certain amount of it I actually find halfway flattering. I mean, if it doesn't cross a certain line, I'm okay with it. Only you know whether or not you feel icky. You know, if this is, you know what, again, please, again, you don't get to look at me this way. You don't get to talk to me this way. I work for you. I'm a bartender. I'm not your, you know, geisha girl. Again, if you wanted me to, if I'm going to be a sex worker, again, I will go be a sex worker somewhere. But, you know, here, so, you know, I would encourage you to sort of push back, but to make sure that it's only incremental. It's incrementally done. You don't, you know, write them a letter saying, I'll see you in court all for, you know, subjecting me to this, but that you start with simply saying, you know, to the perpetrator, and possibly, if you're ready, willing, and able to do something like this, to speak with him, but to also, you know, record it. It would be, and again, I'm not telling you to do that. I'm just mentioning that it is legal and therefore empowering, because having a smoking gun of a statement that he says to you, listen, I'll watch what I say from now on, but hey, lighten up, honey lips, you know, when I see you swear, you know, whatever he says, if it's inculpatory, if he says something that sounds like he shouldn't be talking to a young woman in the workplace this way, or any woman in the workplace this way, that is smoking gun proof. That management will have to, that would be no different than you catching him on tape calling you the N-word if you were a person of color, or saying, you know what, or saying something else that's really obnoxious related to any other protected status. So,
okay.
I don't know, you know, where you have to decide if it's one of these things where, oh, if I lose this job, I'm going to hang myself right now. You know, there are, it's, you could certainly wait, what might be, you could wait to find another potential backstop position. And then, you know, maybe you have a month to work with, and you know, because the other part of this is, and I'll just mention this briefly, and you could certainly call us, you know, in the office tomorrow if you'd like to follow up on this, but that if you complain, when one complains of discriminatory treatment, let's say it just gets worse, and they're just seeing you as an enemy, a pariah, you're just your time bomb, it's not going to work out, they can't keep themselves from retaliating, but you've written a formal letter of complaint, or you've gotten someone on tape, with this sort of smoking gun, you know, negative energy, this gender-based hostility, discriminatory animus, they are not allowed to fire you. That is illegal backlash and retaliation. So what happens is they speak to their lawyer. The lawyer says, hey, you can't fire her now. Maybe you could torture her a little bit, but you can't fire her. And that at least opens the door to the notion of a separation where they pay you some money to go away and move on to the next job. And if they do that, you know, whether you have a lawyer or not, where they're saying, you know what we'll do? It's not working out. This marriage can't be saved. So we're going to pay you severance. We're going to pay you whatever, X number. We're going to pay you 6 months of the pay that you normally make at this restaurant. And you will leave and go collect unemployment and take your cash, sign a release, say you'll never disparage us, you'll never talk bad about us, we'll never talk bad about you, and you move on. And you've still taught them a lesson. They don't like to spend money like that. They probably aren't going to let this guy do it to the next person. And you move on, still feeling that you didn't leave with a cup in your hand crawling away, that, you know, that you didn't go quietly to your rest, that you stood up for yourself, and that you made a difference, and that, you know, at some point, like the legacy, you might be able to tell your own child, your own daughter one day, that, you know what, this is what we do in this family. You know, this is, might not be easy, but this is what feminism is to me. I just don't allow myself to be degraded and treated as a sexualized object in the workplace when that's not my, it's not consensual. That's not my job function. It's not an essential function of my position. They can't do it. It's illegal. So you just have to only incrementally put it out there, put it on the record, and let them resolve it. And if they don't and it gets worse, you call us or you call an attorney, and, you know, to make sure you have all your ducks lined up, and perhaps you can negotiate an exit strategy that will be empowering and will teach them a lesson and give you some money, and you could then ride off into the sunset and get a job where they don't allow, you know, the male overseers to ride, you know, to herd on their female employees and to do what he has been doing to you.
Yeah,
does this
right
make any
on
sense?
It makes a lot, Jack. You know, first of all, I love everything you're saying, and it makes you know, a lot of sense. And, you know, if I have just one moment to comment,
sure,
briefly, I mean, you talk about the 70s and, you know, oh, should I become a sex worker? And, you know, it's just, even reaching out to you now, you know, I, almost all the girls I work alongside with would probably be, you know, just freaking out at the fact that I would even be, like, at all compromising a position like this. As many of them now, it's so commonplace, as many of them have sugar daddies and arrangements that are, you know, where the man is taking care of the sexy, you know, woman with no rights and no voice. And I really take issue with that. So, you know, I really appreciate all this advice, though. I mean, I couldn't find this anywhere else, and I really didn't know where to turn. So, I thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome, Devin. Would you give us a call and let us know how it turns out? We'd love to
hear
back
from you. I most certainly will. I'm actually thinking, as you're speaking, I'm definitely going to follow up with this and look at, weigh things out and see what I can do.
Well, that's great. And good luck, and let us know whether you need any further advice. You can call us, and obviously it will be, as we speak further, all of it will be confidential when you speak to us in our office setting.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much. That's so great, Jack. You've been so helpful.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks,
bye-bye
guys.
Now.
Bye.
And
so
on that note.
Well, that note, I think we have, I've been told we have 2 minutes left. So what would you like to talk about to wrap up today, Deborah?
Well, I don't know. I'm still feeling so hopeless with all of the stuff you talked about at the beginning.
Well,
but, you know, the thing that this person, Devin, just was speaking about, speaking up is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And that's the one thing that I say to women when they call the office and I'm doing intakes. This is not necessarily about compensation and how much money this is going to be worth. But the important issue is taking back your power and standing up. You know, we're calling it the Rosa Parks moment, the Anita Hill moment. But when women have to tolerate that kind of treatment, the whistles, etc., to have that opportunity to stand up and say no. And the more women do that, the more it will spread in our society, and maybe this war on, you know, women will evaporate.
Well, I don't know about evaporation, but the more we all sort of stand up for women, the more women are educated, the more we all, again, speak truth to power in all
of its
forms.
Truth to power.
Perhaps then we will be able to. It's not, the carbon emissions, it's all part of this energy, the 9/11 energy. That energy, the gasp, the collective, we're all in the midst of a collective, like, death rattle now. Okay, so if we can all, I think we just have to keep talking about it, not lose hope and not lose
faith. All
right,
well, let's just, as we have this one last second, next week,
please tune in.
Great show.
We have a terrific show with Sherry Lywant, and we'll be talking about paid sick leave in New York City. So please tune in again to PRN.FM, to Women's Rights in the Workplace, next Monday at 5 p.m. Till then, have a strong and powerful week. Jack Tuckner and Deborah O'Rell, Women's Rights in the Workplace Advocates, signing out. Bye-bye.